Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your loving host, Todd Conklin. Hey, thanks for tuning in. It is a Friday night. It is nice and beautiful. I'm having the best day ever, and I just finished recording a podcast with my buddy Robert Holmes. You're going to get to hear it, and I think it might be one of the best podcasts we've probably recorded ever. And for one reason, this is the most requested topic on the podcast from all of you guys who send me emails and LinkedIn, Dealey, Whoppers, whatever they're called. This is the one you care about, and this is the one we attacked. Robert Holmes has a PhD in mathematics from Oxford in England. He is a smarty pants. In fact, he may define the word smarty pants. He's also a really good friend of mine, and he does nothing but data manipulation, and he does it for the big pharmaceutical companies all over the world. I ask him a question, and this all really comes from Dr. Chuck Pettinger talking about big data, and Jim Barker talking about complexity, and everybody talking about data. And I've said for years, there is no leading data sets for safety prediction. Because if there were leading data sets for safety prediction, we'd have them. Because BP would have already paid for them, lock, stock, and barrel, and they'd share them with us in a minute. I think I could be wrong. And the reason I say that is because of Robert's interview. Robert is remarkable. And I say that a bunch, but I mean it this time. Other times I say it, I'm just faking it. But now I'm totally serious. Robert's going to talk to you about modeling for prediction. Because that's all he does. Now remember, PhD, Oxford, the one in England, not the one in Kansas, for those of you in Winfield for GE Strother Field. He is really, really smart on this topic. And here's what he's going to tell us. He's going to tell us we can model behavior, but we have to understand how to create the model and then how to validate the model. And one of those issues is really the complex one. So it's been a fun week. It's always a fun week for me. I can't believe how much fun I get to have, and I get to have it all the time. And thank you to those of you who are listening for giving me the opportunities to be a part of your company, because it means a lot. I just came back from a very gorgeous trip to central Missouri, maybe south central Missouri, where I was with some guys at a big mine, a mine on the Mississippi River that mines lime. If you combine all those, you'll totally get the total or the title. We spent a bunch of time looking at big haul trucks and loaders and really good people who want to do a good job. And that's amazing. I also want to tell you that my big experiment on gratitude just continues to pay off. I cannot tell you what a turn in my life this whole gratitude experiment has been. I do all these experiments all the time anyway, but this one has been a really high payoff. It's remarkable. And getting to spend time with you, I think, is remarkable as well. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And tell your friends, this podcast is probably one you'll want to share. This podcast has a lot of potential to really change our industry. So listen carefully. Without much further ado, let me jump into this. This is Robert Holmes, PhD, Oxford, brilliant man, but also a super nice man. On a Friday night in Santa Fe, New Mexico, this is what Robert had to say.
Are you talking about old man glasses?
I've got old man glasses, so I can't see the microphone. So as long as it's...
Here is your microphone.
Oh! I'll just try. That's perfect. I'll try not to hiss my sibilance too badly.
No, it's perfect. Perfect. So tell us who you are and why we care.
I'm Robert Holmes.
Nice. You got that. You did that so well. I'm so impressed.
I've done enough introductions to myself at various meetings. I'm Robert Holmes. I'm the chief science officer at a local data analytics company. My background is in various aspects of machine learning, and I've been working in this area since the 1990s in a variety of industries. So the techniques of machine learning, artificial intelligence, agent-based modeling, various sort of advanced statistical techniques, they're all generally applicable. And so you could be using these in, as I've done, the electricity supply industry, in pharmaceuticals, in web-based learning, any number of fields.
So you know the ultimate challenge, right, for safety people, and I don't know how much you know about this, but the challenge is to find leading data. So there's this huge challenge. Every meeting I've been to in the last 25 years, people sit around and talk about we need better leading data points. We need leading indicators. We need indicators that are predictive.
You've got to be able to predict what is going to be happening, what's going to be the good predictors of, you know, the probability of events occurring.
Right.
What's a good indicator of something happening?
And what's crazy is that need to predict, because there's this artificial demand that's really high for a way to predict failure before it happens, there's been this artificial supply that's grown up. And we look at things, Robert, honest to God, we'll go out and look at workers' behavior and we'll say, that's risky behavior, therefore that could lead to accident. When in reality, the question I would ask, and it's a really good question, is what's the difference between a safety shortcut and a process improvement?
That's a good question, and that talks to some of the issues around developing models of human behavior.
That's why you're here. Tell us everything. Because this idea of agency-based modeling, which you're probably going to have to tell us more about, because none of us on this podcast, and I speak for everybody that's listening right now, have the vaguest idea what you're talking about. So tell us what you mean when you say agency-based modeling.
Agency-based modeling is going to be one of the tools in the data scientist's tool chest.
Okay, cool.
And it's definitely an important one, and it's definitely one that we should touch on. But just to talk to your specific question there, it's one of the issues is how you go about modeling. Are you essentially trying to confirm some hypotheses, or are you trying to uncover some hypotheses? Let's think about it in that way.
Nice.
So with safety issues, what there could be a temptation to do is to go into a problem or into an event, whether it's, you know, a general series of events, whether it's a specific event, to go into it with an assumption of what really happened, what were the underlying causes. And then you're going to start collecting data and build models that essentially confirm the prejudices that you went into the analysis with. Now, that is not wholly a bad thing. It's a reasonable statistical technique to put some hypotheses together of a situation and try and see whether the data that you're observing conforms with them or doesn't. But what some of the work that's, you know, started happening in the 90s around machine learning, around pattern recognition, allowed a different approach to be taken. It allows you to essentially start uncovering some of those causes from the available data. So rather than going in with an assumption of what happened, you can just go in with a big pile of data, some very vague ideas about what happened, what caused the event, and you can essentially, you know, let the models learn for themselves what were the key features in the incident.
Oh my God, that's sexy. I mean, that is really attractive to us. Now, tell us, in your world right now, I think it's cute that you said a local data, what do you call it, data analysis company?
Yes.
Like
yes,
every
indeed.
Town has a bunch of data analysis, like there's Joe's
I just assume that that's the word, that Santa Fe is like the rest of the country.
Yeah, well, probably not, but okay. And I think it's just funny. It's cute, and that's why I love you. You currently can use data predictively in the pharmaceutical industry to pretty carefully understand what doctor's going to write what script for what medicine, right? Is that fair?
Yes. So what we're typically doing in the company that I work with at the moment is that we are using the available medical data, and this is insurance claims data. It's data about who has historically written what prescription and in what volume. We're using that to essentially infer the influential connections between peers of physicians. So it's much more about identifying communities of practice.
Which is bingo. I mean, that's right where we are. Keep going.
It's about identifying communities of practice and who the leaders and followers are within these communities. And then, yes, making predictive statements about how their behaviors interrelate.
How accurate are they?
That's a very good question. It's accurate enough to make money off.
Holy crap on a cracker. Because that's a test, right?
It is. The test is, is this something that can be, you know, that can be monetized? Think about it this way. If you had some system that would enable you to go into a Las Vegas casino and go up to one of the roulette tables.
I'm listening. Go ahead. I'm listening.
And essentially predict just at the, you know, 55%, 60% accuracy level, whether this roulette wheel was going to go red or black, you don't need to be right every time,
right,
to make money off it. You just need to push the balance of probability in your favor.
How can we use these agency-based model, one tool, and I understand that, that's really important. How can we use this agency-based modeling to look at the potential of a quality disruption on a manufacturing line or an injury, a cut hand in a construction site?
It's one of the tools that's in the tool chest. What you would be using things like agent-based modeling for is essentially building some of these predictive frameworks. Let me briefly sidebar into what I mean by
agent-based
model.
Baby, take it away. Teach us. We're like putty in your hands. You're the hands. We're the putty.
The notion of agent-based modeling has been kicking around for a couple of decades, and really, what you're doing in one of those models is you are modeling down at the individual level. You recognize the fact in your model that the agent Todd is going to be different from the agent Robert. So we're not just atoms in some big statistical distribution.
So not everybody is the same.
One of the classic examples of this is in modeling disease transmission. So the original models of disease transmission were very much looking at these populations where everyone's somewhat homogenous, and there's going to be a proportion of this population that's infected and then a portion that's already got the disease, and you build all these differential equations that you can solve analytically and make predictions about whether this, you know, this disease is going to die off and when. And that is perfectly reasonable for some cases. But you can do more powerful models, more descriptive models, if you start considering individual entities. And in fact, a lot of work has been done on this locally up at Los Alamos. They've been doing work on this for the last 20 years approximately. And in that case, what you're doing is you have these models where you've got individual little people, and some of them are going to be little people who stay at home, and some will be ones who go and commute off to work, and some will be one who get onto planes and go off to, you know, different parts of the world. And of course, then get models which look very different from the traditional population-based model. So think of the differences, populations versus individuals. I mean, you have to make assumptions about your individuals, and you absolutely need to use statistical techniques to estimate some of the parameters that you're going to use in this model. But really, that's the key difference. It's modeling the population versus modeling the individual within that population.
Wow, that is so appealing to us. So what kind of data sets do you need?
Well, that's absolutely the key point. If you look at the literature on agent-based modeling over the last 20 years, the thing that will strike you is that, A, they're extremely easy to construct. it's very easy to start off with a bunch of assumptions about
a welder, a manufacturer, whatever.
Could be absolutely anything, and it will be very easy for you to take those rules and build some sort of system that kind of looks right when you set the simulation
and
running.
Most people know their workforce well enough, or they're easy enough to touch. You could bring in workers and ask them a series of questions.
And that's exactly the way to build those models.
Oh, tell me more.
So that's exactly the way to build those models and work out what the rules that these agents should be implementing, what those rules should be. The big challenge, though, comes in validating these things. It's very, very easy to build a model. It's very, very hard to validate it. And to validate it, you need to be comparing your model against data, historic data, typically. And that means that you've got to be gathering the right data. It means that you've got to be, you know, getting that in a proper, unbiased way, which of course you never can, because it's the real world and you're using data from real events. You've got to account for the fact that, hey, I've got lots of data on things going right. I don't have that much data on things going wrong. So there's a lot of challenges on the data side. So honestly, constructing the models is not that hard. Validating the models is extremely difficult. And as I was saying earlier, if you look at the literature, it's something that you will find not many people do a good job of.
But you do, right? You guys do. I mean, you're the lead scientist, right?
Yes.
You're, if all the scientists, you lead them.
I
am your leader.
Company, yes.
Follow me.
Yes, that's right. That's
I am
right.
The lead scientist. Yeah. So what if I told you that I interviewed a guy, I don't know, a couple months ago, who's talking about putting analytics like Fitbits, you know, actual analytics on workers to measure when they do something improper. How's that strike you? Because I got to tell you, from my side of the microphone, that couldn't be much more insulting.
I agree completely. The notion that you're measuring them doing something wrong is just a huge biasing factor.
So what's interesting is the idea that I could construct a model for a 30-year guy and another model for a 20-year guy and another model for a 10-year guy and another model for a 5-year guy and a model for a 1-year guy. All those models would be different, but they would all be relatively easy to construct.
They're easy to construct, but as I say, the hardest part is then validating these things. And for that, you do need data.
But the data I can get you.
Well, the data's easy because
I own the people.
But there's a question of how you get the data. And your Fitbit example is a great example. It is a great example of how not to do it. You really
Amen, brother.
You really do need to gather that data essentially in a judgment-free way. You don't want to be messing up the experiment that you're doing, the model you're creating, by the fact that you're gathering this data. It's kind of like the Hawthorne effect.
Absolutely.
And so
now we should take a moment for people who don't know Hawthorne effect. Classic study, 1930s General Electric.
Correct. Yes.
Here's what they learned: when we go out and observe workers, we turn the lights up because we're observing the workers and their performance gets better. When we're not observing them, their performance goes down. It must have to do with the lighting, so let's turn the lighting up to make everyone work better, but it doesn't work.
The original study was basically to look at the level of illumination in the GE factory, and so what they wanted to do was test the productivity of workers at different levels of illumination. But what they discovered was that the simple fact of observing the workers, of paying attention to what they were doing, frankly, of obviously caring about them,
exactly, made their
productivity go up. Now, it should be said, there's been a lot of work subsequently on the Hawthorne effect that suggests that maybe the original study was a little wonky, to put it mildly. But the point stands that you want to be careful when you're gathering your data not to induce some sort of biasing behavior. I can give you a really specific example of this one.
Sure, please do.
That's safety related. Some of the package delivery companies, very big in terms of gathering data on, whether the vehicle is, making left turns rather than right turns, whether the engines are running, whether the doors are open, and crucially, whether the seatbelt is on.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that is the data is being gathered. But it's not in the sense of just gathering data to build some models. People are already being forced to alter their behavior on the results of that data gathering. So if you are seen to be doing too much driving with your seatbelt off, or if your seatbelt is seen to be off for too long, then you're dinged on that.
Punished, in fact.
Indeed. But at the same time, if you wear your seatbelt, it slows down your delivery process. You can't leap out of the cab quite as quickly. And there have been sort of documented cases of drivers essentially leaving the seatbelt permanently fastened behind them, never wearing it, which is okay because that's not being measured. What's being measured is that the seatbelt is closed.
The click, right?
That's right. And so this is one of those occasions when the measurement is already impacting behavior. In this case, not in a good way, but it's certainly going to really mess up any attempt you would do at constructing good, reliable, robust models off that data. So, in other words, when you're gathering the data, the data has to be gathered essentially in this judgment-free manner. Right now, we're gathering information. We're trying to understand what's happening, not even in terms of, what the problems are, just trying to get the data so we can get some understanding of what's happening. It would be a terrible mistake to prematurely start, imposing management's thoughts on what the right value for this particular parameter should be. Again, that's the sort of thing that's going to terribly bias your data. People are going to react to that. It's going to mess up the data that you're gathering, and it's going to mess up the models that you build off that data.
How powerful is the management's understanding of work? So let's talk Frederick Taylor a minute. You want to? Taylorism?
Yes.
The planner is always smarter than the worker. How much has that sort of created a cognitive bias?
I don't believe that for a second.
I don't either, brother. Tell us more, Robert. You're singing to the choir.
The notion that the planner is more intelligent than the resource being planned is quite simply nonsense. And you can see this whenever you have someone produce some sort of either reward scheme, through pay for a supposedly desired behavior, or some sort of penalty for some undesired behavior.
What about procedures? Procedures, pretty much, I could take you anywhere, and it's a pretty good bet that the procedure is not written by the worker. It's written by some kind of planner, manager, who has the global understanding of how procedures work. How screwed up is that?
Well, it is, and that's certainly another aspect of it. The fact that the procedures are being written by people who believe they know what they're doing, but the fact that they're not daily practitioners, frankly, they don't. But there's an even more insidious issue is that when people start putting, when a management structure starts putting in drivers for what they believe should be the correct behavior, people are very intelligent. People are very good at gaming systems. So they will find ways of using your rules that are going to benefit them directly. And why the heck shouldn't they?
Stop. Okay, everyone listening, push the 15-second back. I want you to listen to this three times in a row. What Robert said brought a tear to my eye. It was so incredibly brilliant. What do we do with that? Why wouldn't you game the system? I can't think of a reason to not game the system. If this is what you measure me and how you do my remuneration, how you pay me, why wouldn't I get good at the things you care about that you use to base my salary on? Why wouldn't they do that?
Indeed, and they do, and because people at that level are essentially rational beings.
Absolutely, brother.
So that brought me to a dead stop. Where were we? Where were we going with this conversation?
No. We're talking about The notion that you bring a tool to the table that most people don't even realize exists, that actually has a more likely ability to predict the future than a less likely ability to predict the future.
Well, one of the things that you can do with the, let's say with the agent-based modeling, is that you can explore the effects of different rules that these players, that these agents might be implementing. And that's the sort of thing that you can uncover in conversations with the people who were, as it were, on the shop floor. You can speak with them and find out, if you're a trusted interviewer, you can find out what it is that's driving them. What are the drivers that management are sort of saying they need to, what are the metrics that management are saying they need to meet? And they will hopefully, if you're that trusted interviewer, they'll tell you hopefully the ways they can not exactly manipulate the system, but let's just say work within the system.
I gotcha.
You can then start exploring the implications of that within these agent-based models. You essentially code up these rules in your little population of agents. You make some good assumptions about what the parameters should be on your models, and for that you need a lot of data. You need to do some statistics to get good, reliable numbers on these things. And then you let your predictive models do their things. And you run them repeatedly. You run them many, many times because they're all highly probabilistic. They're all highly stochastic. So what you need to do is run them again and again and again and again. And essentially, if the same sort of result keeps coming out, if the same rough prediction, we think there's going to be X events within such and such a period, and the error bars on that are nice and tight, and it doesn't seem to matter where you start your simulation, you always end up with something that's in that range of number of events per year, then you can be pretty confident that the number you're predicting is good, real, and it's then something that you can manage to.
God, that's just amazing. Are you interested in using your talents for good? Not that the pharmaceutical industry is not a good place. We could have an entire different podcast on that. But how do we take this knowledge, this agent-based modeling idea, or just the idea that different workers behave differently, but within those worker categories, it's pretty easy to create a model that's relatively...
Yeah. The important thing is that none of this is rocket science. Think about...
But that is your background.
kind of. The issue is that none of this is terribly complicated from an analytical perspective. What you need to do is as it were, build some sort of hybrid system, something that's going to use just enough of statistics to be useful, just enough of agent-based systems, just enough of machine learning, because they've all got different views on how you solve problems.
Right.
And honestly, there is a hybrid vigor. If you try and solve any given, be it commercial or industrial or real-world problem, and you just use this one tool, you're inevitably doomed to failure. The most reliable way of doing it is using these various tools, using them appropriately, pulling them together, and that's actually pulling them together in an appropriate way is not trivial, and you need to find people you can work with who can do that. But the good thing is you don't need world leading experts in machine learning or in statistics or in to do it. The important thing is pulling together these disparate disciplines and building this sort of little, quite simple, hybrid model that pulls just enough from these various areas to be useful and to build you these solid models.
Can people contact you?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
How would they get a hold of you? I mean, do you want them to? Think over it. A lot of people listen to this, so think of it.
I'd be more than happy to discuss this with anyone who wants to talk about it. It's a fascinating subject. As I say, I've been in machine learning and those sort of areas since the 90s. I love the way that these techniques are generally applicable. This is, the whole realm of safety is clearly one that's got societal impact. It's societally important.
Absolutely.
And so, yes, I would love to continue this conversation with anybody.
I knew this would be good. You overperformed, baby. This was amazing. How do people get a hold of you?
Best way is my personal email, which is robert@roberthomes.org. Okay. I'm sure the link's going to be in the podcast.
I'll put the link in the podcast and make it. Did we cover everything? This was a shorty. I know I'm going to have you back.
I'm more than happy to come back and discuss any area in more depth.
What do you think?
Would like.
Did this suck or did you like it?
I enjoyed this.
You were amazing. Deal. You were like a rock star. You're so comfortable behind the microphone. And what you told us, I think, is very, very, very enlightening. And quite honestly, pretty encouraging.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Thanks, buddy.
To hear that. Not still. A real pleasure, Todd. Thank you for inviting me.
You are the best, my friend. Thank you. Wow. What'd you think? I'm telling you, this is crazy. He is so smart. And when he talks about how easy it is to model worker behavior based upon where the worker is, man, that changed everything for me because he's right. I could write a pretty good model for how a 30-year veteran's going to respond on an oil rig. I could probably write a relatively good model for a 10-year veteran. I bet I could write a pretty good model for a 5-year veteran. Those are all really predictable things we can model. And if we can model those, can we in fact predict what they'll do based upon the context and conditions around them? And I loved how Robert never let me not deal into the fact that what we really measure are the context and conditions that are constantly changing. I don't know what you thought. I'm curious to see what you think, actually. But I thought this was really helpful. And in fact, this is the direction that I pushed Tom Krause in. And this is the direction that I pushed Chuck Pettinger in. These guys that work data and use data as data scientists, I respect them immensely. I've spent my entire career working with them. But I want them to think about other methods they can use besides the classic linear methods in order to predict outcomes. And this may be the answer that's closest to predictive data as I can imagine finding. At least it's one we ought to think about. That's the podcast. What do you think? We ought to keep doing this crap, don't you think? It's worthwhile, that's for sure. It was a very fun night. It was fun spending the time with you. As always, learn something new every day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.